From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I'm honored to introduce my running mate for the Democratic nomination for Lieutenant Governor, a friend of mine for more than 30 years, Paul Vallis.
I just want to thank the governor for this opportunity to come and to serve under him. Second fiddle, third fiddle, second banana, fifth banana, green bananas, doesn't make any difference to me. I have no problem playing second fiddle or whatever instrument in the orchestra Pat wants me to play.
Got a question, please?
The answer is no. Paul, I'll explain it. He lives in Palos Heights, okay? He votes in Palos Heights, and he's been living there for a good long time, more than enough to comply with the Constitution.
That's Governor Pat Quinn and his running mate, Paul Vallis. And Paul Vallis having to answer for where he lives or votes, as he's been out of state for a number of years working, most recently in Connecticut. Vallis, of course, going to be in an unusual position of being the number two person, the second banana, the second fiddle, or whatever instrument it was, as he said. We'll be talking about Paul Vallis and other issues this week around Illinois state government and politics. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Our panel on State Week includes Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, Brian Mackey, State House reporter for WUIS and Illinois Public Radio, and our guest this week, Carrie Lester, who covers the Capitol for the Associated Press. Carrie, thanks for joining us.
It's nice to be back.
And Brian and Carrie, we have Paul Vallis. Of course, that was announced last week, but Vallis came out and greeted the press this week, early in the week. And is his residency an issue that we're going to be contending with for much time, or is this just a quick flash in the pan?
Bill, I don't think so. We had Burton Oldelson, who was the election attorney who unsuccessfully challenged Rahm Emanuel's residency, make some comments this week and say it's not a similar issue with Vallis. Vallis does come home. He sleeps there. He owns the home. And in addition, his wife and I think it's either two or three sons reside there. So it seems like he can make a very, very strong case for residency if he is going to be challenged.
Brian, anything to the contrary?
Yeah, no, I saw that he had testified, I think, and I can't remember if it was in a lawsuit or in some sort of hearing in Connecticut, where he had said when he was working, he was the superintendent, or is the superintendent in the Bridgeport schools there, and he had made a comment about how, yes, I'm working here, but my residence is back in Illinois. And that was a year ago before I think he or maybe Governor Quinn or anyone else was thinking about him coming back to run as the lieutenant governor candidate this year. And so he does seem to be on fairly safe ground. That's not to say that someone won't try and make an issue out of it, although again, we need to remember that the governor doesn't even have any opponents in the primary this year. So there's, I mean, it would have to be probably somebody from the Republican side trying to cross over and interfere with the Democratic ticket.
And not necessarily unheard of, Charlie Wheeler, to do something like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as I've told my class when we talk about the courts, anybody can file anything they want in the court. The only condition would be that you pay the filing fee. On the other hand, in the Rahm Emanuel case that was mentioned earlier, in essence, the Illinois Supreme Court said residence is kind of where your heart is. Because in the mayor's case, when he was running for mayor, somebody else was living in the house. He had rented it out, and he had really no ties to Chicago in the same sense that that Paul Vallis has to the southwest suburbs. But the court said it's what you intend. And in fact, if you look at members of Congress in not just Illinois but in a lot of other states, there's quite a few of them, for all practical purposes, live in Washington, D.C. They maintain a mail drop, if you will, back in their home state to keep their residency. And the idea that Paul Vallis lives in the suburbs and works somewhere else is not at all surprising, because that there's a lot of people who commute to work longer distances than from O'Hare Airport to Bridgeport, Connecticut.
If I feel anything out of this, what I've seen is certainly the conventional wisdom, and you could hear it when the reporters were asking questions, it's if they were elected, how will he be as a number two? And that seems to be on everyone's mind. We usually forget about lieutenant governor candidates, forget about lieutenant governor, but I would presume they would try to have some responsibilities for a job with no responsibilities when he's elected. But is that an issue that could come where there could be friction if he has to play a subordinate in this relationship? And as lieutenant governor, you do.
I think it's unquestionable that there will come a time when Paul Vallis is going to start speaking his mind and take up that hair on fire style that we've seen in the past. But if you watched his body language at that press conference this week, it really was amazing how he stood back, he deferred to Quinn. I think if you clocked it, it was about 4.5 minutes before he said anything. And you're going, okay, this guy has changed his tune.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we've seen the governor give I mean, I think that Governor Quinn was pretty well marginalized during the Blagojevich administration, which kind of, I think, worked to his benefit when he had to step up. He could say, oh, I didn't have a big hand in what was happening before. But, and he has given some smaller initiatives to his lieutenant governor, who has kind of made the best she can. I mean, we get press releases all the time from the lieutenant governor's office where she's dealing with college readiness and career readiness and trying to improve people getting training in that. She's on deals with river coordinating councils in the state. She's dealt with rural agricultural issues. So, I mean, you know, they get a portfolio of issues and they try and make the best they can with it. The question will be, you know, whether Governor Quinn, you know, if he is reelected, would try to put Mr. Vallis's extensive experience in education and budgetary and fiscal matters to some greater use than, you know, coordinating river, you know, river protection in Illinois.
That would strike me as being a logical thing. With Vallis's experience going back to the days when he was a staffer for the Senate Revenue Committee, and then he was head of what used to be called the Economic and Fiscal Commission, it's now the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, plus the work he did as Revenue Director in Chicago, as the head of the Chicago Public School Operation, in Philadelphia and New Orleans, he's got a wealth of background. I think it'd be fair to say, in terms of budget matters, finance matters, education matters, he's probably the most qualified lieutenant governor candidate the state has ever seen. And so I suspect that what Pat Quinn would do would be assign responsibility in those areas to Paul Vallis. Just as in the past, governors have assigned responsibility for economic development or for higher education reorganization to their lieutenant governor.
I do think it's also interesting to look across onto the other side of the aisle here, what this says about the Republican nominees for lieutenant governor and just what a sort of substantial pick Paul Vallis is. He's a very well-known quantity. He was a candidate for governor himself in the past. And if you look on the Republican side, there are many more unknown people. And, I'll leave it to listeners to judge for themselves what that says about, you know, the governor, his pick, or maybe Charlie has some thoughts on that. But, I mean, it is striking that Governor Quinn went after somebody who is a known quantity, for better or worse, and, you know, but has a lot of gravitas that he brings with him as compared to some of the choices on the other side.
Well, what I would say, and at the risk of sounding, what would you say, biased or prejudiced, among the Republican lieutenant governor candidates, the only one who I think qualifies for the job is Jill Tracy, Representative Jill Tracy. And I say that because I think the main reason we have a lieutenant governor is if something befalls the governor, God forbid. And so you want someone who could step in and do it. And while the other three Republican lieutenant governor candidates, I'm sure, are fine people, and they've actually had a little bit of experience here and there, Tracy is the only one who would have any knowledge of state government, its workings, and be able to move into that position. And Paul Vallis is head and shoulders, as I said before, above anybody who's probably ever run for lieutenant governor before.
I think it speaks to the fact that this will help the Quinn campaign net moderate suburban votes. If you look over to the Republican side, Bruce Rauner's pick, the Wheaton city councilwoman, she may have had that place and served to kind of net some swing votes, some women's votes, some independent votes. But now I think Vallis is going to give that campaign a run for their money.
And that's a good point, Carrie, because when Vallis ran unsuccessfully in the 2002 Democratic primary for governor, he actually won the suburban and Collar County vote. He did better than either Rod Blagojevich or Roland Barris in that area.
Carrie, I think go ahead.
Oh, I was going to add, in terms of context, I think it's important to remember that this is the first time that the governor and lieutenant governor are paired going into the primary. And so I think this is the first time in Illinois history. I mean, we've seen lieutenant governors become liabilities for governor just even in the last election cycle, where a former pawnbroker had managed to win the nomination and ended up bowing out, and that's where Sheila Simon was appointed. This is the first time where we can judge the gubernatorial candidates based on who they've picked. And we've certainly seen in presidential elections that bad choices for vice president can actually, you know, have some effect. I mean, it's not often that vice presidents would, you know, and they're certainly not determinative, but they can have an effect in voters' minds. You know, was this person serious? You know, were they really thinking of somebody who could take over the control of government should that become necessary?
I want to move it over to the Republican side of things a little bit more. Carrie, you alluded to Bruce Rauner, but let's talk a little bit about money. He is throwing $500,000 towards his campaign, and that self-funding will mean something.
It does. It raises it raises the cap, meaning that they all can spend more during the campaign, and certainly money is Rauner's trump card. I mean, he can be self-funded. He's done very well fundraising so far. But personally, I was a little puzzled with the timing of this. Why now? I don't have an answer from the campaign yet, but it begs the question of if perhaps they were a little threatened by the Vallis choice.
And Charlie, when we're talking about the financing here, that was something that never was around at all before, right?
Well, as part of the campaign limitations that were enacted a couple of years ago, there is a provision that says if any one campaign passes this threshold, then all the limits are off for everybody in the race. And in essence, I believe the threshold was $250,000. And when Rauner put in that $500,000, that blew well past it. He had been at something like $249,000, just below the threshold in terms of his individual contribution. And by blowing past it, that means the gates are open for everyone. Now,
not really a surprise in an Illinois election is what it's...
Yeah, and I say the gates are open for everyone, but not everyone has the wherewithal to go through the gates as Mr. Rauner does. There's also been an independent committee formed by the Democrats to help Pat Quinn, and because they are independent of the operation, they're not going to be bound by any limits either. And so you have what I would guess probably will turn out to be the most expensive governor race in Illinois history.
Although, from what I've read, if Mr. Rauner doesn't win the primary, then the caps would go back on, right? And we should clarify, this is not, other candidates don't just get to give their own money to the campaign. They can raise unlimited from anyone.
Oh, yeah,
now.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, all the limits are off for the primary.
I think this poses a big problem for Bill Brady and Kirk Dillard. Dan Rutherford, the state treasurer, has proven already to be a fairly prolific fundraiser, but Dillard and Brady have been kind of left behind in the dust with the campaign finance filings I've seen so far this campaign.
Now, on the campaign, Rutherford did come out with actually a little bit of a policy discussion this week when it talks about long-term planning for state facilities. You care to break that down quickly for us, Brian?
Yeah, and this is something that's sort of a rehash. He had introduced legislation about this years ago, and then he'd also talked about it last year. But this is just one of the, you know, we've heard a lot of talk about state government needing to cut back and cutting spending and bringing the budget under control. And one of the ways that both Governors Quinn and before him Blagojevich say they've tried to do that is by closing facilities. Of course, Governor Blagojevich was often accused of doing so in a vindictive political manner. He had, I remember at one point, he targeted, I think it was a big prison in the district of the state Senate Republican leader for closure. But, you know, there's been a lot of controversy when the governor has tried to close facilities, governors of both parties. And so what Treasurer Rutherford is saying is that he wants some sort of – he would put in some sort of long-term planning process here. So you can say not just for facilities that might close but ones that might stay open, and then what do you do with those facilities? We this year closed the prisons in Tams and Dwight here in Illinois. As far as I know, they're both still sitting empty. There was talk of repurposing part of Dwight Prison, you know, having a county use it as kind of an overflow jail for their purposes, but that has been put on hold the last I saw. So, you know, there's this question about what do you do with state facilities if you are going to close them.
This is State Week in Review. Just ahead, the potential exists out there for a legislative session the week of December 3rd, perhaps to deal with pensions.
Support for State Week in Review comes from the Illinois State Bar Association, whose activities include proposing and shaping legislation, educating the public, and supporting the courts and the rule of law. Information at IllinoisLawyerFinder.com.
Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and the AP's Kerry Lester. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Kerry, there was a memo circulating, at least to Democratic lawmakers, that hinted at least that we might be back to talk about pensions. People were expecting something like this. What do you know?
Yeah, you know, this was just a little interesting development this week. Last week, during the final scheduled week of the legislature's annual fall session, we heard some rumblings that they could be called back to deal with pensions. You know, we've had this pension issue outstanding for months, for years, and there's this bipartisan committee and now legislative leaders that have stepped in and are trying to hash out a deal. And reportedly they're close, but we went the whole week last week without hearing much about it. So we got our hands on an email from House Speaker Michael Madigan's chief of staff, Tim Mapes, that went to members of the House Democratic Caucus that said, keep December 3rd, 4th, and possibly 5th open. And other caucus emails subsequently followed. But the interesting part about this timing is this pension vote is controversial and could spell some trouble for some lawmakers bidding for re-election. And December 3rd is the day after the filing deadline for primary challengers closes with the State Board of Elections.
Now, I hear this note also could be their attempt to see whether they would even have enough bodies to get to Springfield to have a vote that would work the way they wanted it, should they ultimately take up the issue, Charlie Wheeler.
Well, to me, it's interesting because any vote in the first week of December for it to become effective immediately would require three-fifths support. And I would be absolutely flabbergasted if whatever pension plan the leaders agree to is going to get three-fifths support from the rank-and-file members. So assuming that it passes with a simple majority, 60 votes in the House, 30 votes in the Senate, it can't become effective before next July 1st. And I don't know if the game plan is, if it doesn't become effective until July 1st, maybe there won't be any suits filed until July 1st, and that will get us past the election so we don't have to worry so much about the unions working against us because we've gutted benefits for retired teachers and state workers and others. I don't know if that's the rationale at all. It seems to me that once the law is signed, it is the law, even if it isn't effective yet. And so I think you could go ahead and file a legal challenge against it. But obviously, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know. But I know that there are, what would you say, initiatives already underway, planning for the lawsuit, figuring out who the plaintiffs are going to be, figuring out what the briefs are going to say. So I'm not sure what the, as Kerry said, it's kind of mystifying why they would choose this particular week to do it.
And related to the topic of pensions, the governor didn't really want to say where he was on the Chicago Park District pension bill. And as we talked last week, that was passed quickly in the fall session of the legislature, and some have said it could be a test case. Why is Governor Quinn refusing to say where he stands on a pension issue?
You know, I was just finishing up a report on this just before I stepped in here to tape this program, and it does present a little bit of a sticky wicket for Quinn, because this pension deal that seemingly was going along smoothly between the Chicago Park District and its labor union, ultimately, because of some last-minute mandatory changes, was opposed by the union, which is also one of Quinn's biggest campaign contributors. So Quinn was in Springfield this week. He was announcing some capital investments at a convention center here, and we tried to pin him on it, and he just gave a very blanket statement of, oh, I've only read what's in the newspapers, and it's on my desk, but, you know, I'll review it like I review any other bill.
He did not mention, however, that a delegation apparently from the union, the Service Employees International Union, had met with him, reportedly, by our own Amanda Finicky had that in one of her stories. And so presumably he knows a little bit more maybe than he's read in the newspapers, but this is pretty typical answer of Quinn when he doesn't want to tip his hand on something. He just says, well, we're studying that issue. I haven't really had time to consider it yet, and we'll just have to get back to you.
Charlie, any thoughts related to the governor's reluctance to say where he stands on that?
Well, it's kind of related in that at that same news conference, reporters tried to press him about whether or not the income tax increase should be made permanent. It's set to expire on January 1st of 2015, and all he wanted to talk about was pensions. And I'm thinking to myself, if I'm a reporter, I'm not going to let him get away with that stuff. Because in early February, he has to propose a budget for next fiscal year. And the income tax increase gets scaled back dramatically halfway through the fiscal year. So as a practical matter, he's going to have $2 billion less to spend. He has to propose a budget based on what the actual reality is. And so he's got to figure out a way to carve out $2 billion from the state's current budget. And it's not going to be a pretty sight. And I think the Republican candidates for governor also should have their feet held to the fire and say exactly what they would do if the income tax increase is allowed to drop back the way the law now requires, and not just dancing around.
And I'd like to ask you, Charlie, I mean, is there any way, any scenario in which, let's say, they magically come up with some sort of pension agreement after years of disagreement, they get something through? More than likely, it's not going to be able to take effect until next summer at the earliest, as you mentioned earlier, both because of the vote thresholds required, you know, in the Constitution, and because the pension systems will need time to ramp up and give retirees and current workers a chance to make some of the, you know, decisions they might have to make and implement these changes. So it's going to be next summer before that law would even be able to take effect. And then there are going to be the court challenges. So, I mean, I can't even imagine that they would try and book any savings from this pension change into next year's budget. And in the past, I mean, I haven't asked anyone that about that recently, but in the past, people have said, no, we would not, you know, take those savings immediately. We'd wait and make sure that it could get through the courts.
Yeah, and even if they did decide to take the savings immediately, which I don't think the law would allow, but again, I'm not a lawyer, the savings that people are talking about in the first year are only in the range of $1 billion. Now, that's a lot of money. But when you're dealing with a situation where you're going to have a revenue loss of $2 billion on a $35 billion base, and more than half of that base is already committed, you can't get away from making those payments without changing substantive law, and he can't propose a budget based on changes in substantive law that haven't occurred yet. And so I think he's in a real bind. And as I say, I would challenge the Republican gubernatorial candidates not to lay back in the weeds and give some goofy response about, oh, we'll cut waste and mismanagement, because that's just malarkey.
Well, Karnak says we'll Karnak says we'll keep asking, and they'll keep dodging, as they've done consistently.
On that,
all
and,
of them.
And gay marriage, which is another, you know, little pebble in my shoe. It's not an issue, or it's going to become law, are some of the responses we're hearing from Republican candidates at this stage in the game. And I'd like to think that they're going to, you know, keep getting pressed, and eventually they're going to have to answer.
And if that's the only answer that they have, and they seriously haven't given it any more thought than that, I would say they're not qualified to be governor.
And related to the issue of same-sex marriage, by the way, Rutherford did say that he would allow it to remain law, but the Catholic bishop in Springfield got some publicity this week related to the issue of same-sex marriage, Brian.
Yeah, he did. He put out a press release. He is actually in Baltimore, or was in Baltimore this week at a big conference of bishops here where they elected a new leader. There was some national coverage of that. But he put out a press release that said he was going to hold, and I'm going to quote here, prayers of supplication and exorcism in reparation for the sin of same-sex marriage. And I think a lot of people immediately saw that word exorcism. And, you know, for the average person, they hear the word exorcism and they think of the movie The Exorcist, or the sort of really sensational ways of viewing that. I mean, I think what's actually happening here is this is, you know, it is not uncommon for bishops to hold prayer services on behalf of trying to get some sort of legislation. And we've seen that with immigration matters, for example. But, you know, this one is pegged to same-sex marriage, and I think that word exorcism is grabbing a lot of attention. I've frankly had limited success trying to figure out exactly what this, you know, where this places in the hierarchy of Catholic doctrine and how it works. I'm still trying to figure that out. The bishop has not been available for an interview since he put out this press release. But he's timing this thing. He's going to have this service the same day, about an hour after Governor Quinn plans to have, or hopes to have, I should say, a few thousand people witness him signing the same-sex marriage legislation into law in Chicago. About an hour later, the bishop here in Springfield will be holding this prayer service.
My very first journalism job was actually working as a reporter for the Archdiocese of Chicago's newspaper. And so I've been interested to watch Cardinal Francis George's response to same-sex marriage legislation. And he, although he certainly opposes it, he's gone to war with some journalists, including the Sun-Times' Mark Brown. He takes more of a professorial approach. And so with Bishop Pepperocki in Springfield, I think what is so interesting is that he's really kind of trying to fight this on the front lines himself. The day of a gay marriage rally at the state capitol, when thousands descended to support the legislation, he was barring some members of this rainbow sash movement, Catholics who have since come out and said they were gay, from entering his cathedral. So it is interesting.
If they were wearing a rainbow sash as a show of protest, he said they would not be allowed. And I think what I read is that there were actually more police there on standby than actual protesters who were trying to go to the church.
Right. No, and I certainly wasn't there to see the volume there, but it is interesting in the overt approach he's taking.
And certainly that has drawn a lot of attention. But you pointed out two differences, and it appears the cardinal may be being a little more political in the way he says things, and the bishop, as you said, on the front line, he's certainly taking a stand of where he views it and is being quite blunt about it. That's all the time we have for this edition of State Week. Thanks to Carrie Lester of the Associated Press. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org, or if using a desktop or laptop, find it on iTunes by searching for State Week in Review. Production assistance today provided by Cynthia Sieber. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.